You're with RN First Bite, and you can hear some pepper being crunched and cracked there in the background. But we're not making a savoury meal here. What we're preparing is drinks. And we're preparing drinks that don't come from today. They're, in fact, the kind of drinks you might have found in favour in some of the cocktail bars of Gold Rush Melbourne. And how do I know that? Because a man sitting opposite me has brought all these ingredients in. He's a self-described cocktail historian, Sebastian Rayburn. Welcome to RN First Bite.
Hello.
How does one become who you are?
I worked with a bar putting together sort of a history of cocktails you might know of, and daiquiris and martinis and stuff. And during putting those histories together, there were these hints that Melbourne was a cocktail place. And there was very little sort of secondary information, but there were little newspaper articles and little references to this era when Melbourne was known for its cocktails. And I just got so interested in it and wanted to dig it up. And that era, ice was the symbol of wealth, because all of the ice right up to sort of the late 1860s was shipped from Massachusetts.
Why?
So they would cut it out of frozen lakes and frozen rivers in Massachusetts. They'd pack it in straw and sawdust, put it on a wooden boat and sail it to Melbourne, and come up the Yarra and they'd unload these massive blocks. And from there, they'd cut it into more usable blocks. And every morning they'd have runners that would deliver it to all the restaurants in Melbourne. So it was very expensive. Because if you're in Australia and it's the 1850s and 1860s, you didn't have any commercial ice production. So the only ice you could get was really, I mean, you could maybe get snow in winter from miles away, but that melts quite quickly, whereas the sort of hard block ice out of a frozen lake...
That goes back decades.
Yeah, so that ice, you could ship it.
Tell me about one of the famous drinks of the time, the sherry cobbler.
It was the most popular drink in the world in that era. I mean, it was sadly not an Australian invention. It was well known around the place, but we were certainly really well known for making them. And it's one of its key ingredients is, well, sherry is a sherry cobbler, but also the key thing with ice. So an original sherry cobbler, which I'm going to make a variation of here, is a nice dry sherry with a little sugar, and we've got some orange peel and a slice of orange. Now, the slice of fresh orange would have also been quite an extravagant sort of thing.
And in fact, in your research, Sebastian, you found a glowing endorsement of this drink in the Sydney Morning Herald.
Yeah, no, this is Sydney Morning Herald from 1857, and it cut it down a bit, but it goes like this. Just now, when of all passing events, a passing cloud would be the pleasantest to chronicle, when the blue sky glares like a maniac's eye with hot unrest, when of all mere mortal muscle is in danger of frizzling up like an overdone rasher, and the most succulent humanity seems turning into toast, exertion of any kind appears ridiculous, and lotus eating in its modern form of Havana puffing and sherry cobbler drinking is certainly the only rational mode of spending an Australian summer.
Cheers. I associate sherry, I have to say, this is terrible to admit, but my mother drank sherry regularly, daily, and in a good way, and I associate it with older people. But sherry, is fortified wine a popular drink these days?
It's coming back. You know, in a strange sort of way, people hate to drink what their parents drank. Could be. And really, the Australian wine industry was built on fortified wines. You know, that's what Penfolds were famous for, as it's initially. And the other thing about fortifieds is they travel. It's much harder to get wines to travel back then. Glass was expensive. It was delicate and breakable. So quite often they put them in barrels. And you put a barrel on a ship and ship it around the world. And if it's, you know, filled with a light white, it ain't like that when it arrives. Whereas if it's a fortified wine, it'll survive the journey.
So, Sebastian, in your research in compiling this manifesto on the history of cocktails and the gold rush, did you discover, in fact, that Melbourne was one of the great centres of cocktail making back in these days?
Yeah, it was. And there was a few key bars that really led it. And it had to do with the huge immigration and mingling of different cultures that occurred in Melbourne, you know, when every sort of man and his dog was keen to get out here.
The first great resources boom.
It was indeed. And the Ballarat Gold Rush was, I mean, it's the single largest alluvial gold deposit ever discovered. It was so much larger than sort of what was happening in California and the rest of the world. So it was really globally quite an important event, and it brought people from everywhere. I mean, people would come in off the gold fields who would, you know, come down from Ballarat with pockets full of gold nuggets, and they would sit in the Café de Paris and order bread and butter, and they'd take out a £10 note, put it in the bread and eat it, just to say, I don't care.
That's obscene wealth, isn't it?
And the thing is, it was, you know, the people who often did best were those who, you know, they were brave, wild men who were prepared to go out into the middle of nowhere with, there was no sanitation, there was no food, they had to live off the land, there was no clean water, you know, so they were pretty, you know, rough folk. And then they would sort of, you know, come back into Melbourne with staggering amounts of money.
So was this uptake in cocktails because they wanted to flaunt their new wealth, even though they might not have known all the sophistications and nuances of what they were drinking?
And it was also, I guess, also part of a global cocktail phenomena.
So it was fashion.
It was. And right at that time, London were famous for cocktails and New York was famous for cocktails. The first cocktail book was published in 1862. When the first cookbook in Australia was published in 1864 by Patrick Abbott, it contained a whole chapter on drinks that had various sort of punches and different cocktails in there. So it was definitely part of the cosmopolitan modern culture of the day.
Is there any cocktail that was grown in this country?
Well, maybe. We think so. It's a bit earlier than the Gold Rush, and it has to do with Colonel Davey, who I believe was the fourth governor of Tasmania. And when he arrived in Hobart to take control of the state, as it were, his first action on getting off the ship was to go into the first bar he saw, which was a sort of an unsalubrious dockside tavern, and throw a bag full of Spanish silver dollars on the bar and demand drink for everyone, and that the publican sit down with him and bring a bottle of brandy, a bottle of rum and some beer. And he proceeded to mix up this drink and force the publican to sort of go drink for drink with him. And while this was all happening, he sends off one of his men, who by this point is completely inebriated, as a messenger. And about an hour later, the 40th Regiment show up at the door with the military marching band playing the national anthem. And the publican, who can barely stand up, says, "Well, who on earth are you?" And he says, "Well, I'm Colonel Davey, the new governor of Tasmania. Pleased to meet you. You're a great sport and you're going to drink this cocktail, blow my skull off, with me every day." So now it's a mixture of rum, which was sort of your working
class staple diet, you know, of alcohol, wasn't it?
If you couldn't afford the good stuff, you were probably drinking rum. And brandy, which is what you would have if you were rich and an officer. And where a cocktail of that era was really spirits mixed with sugar and water.
Yes.
Colonel Davey sort of did one better and really proved that even Australia's cocktail culture was built on beer. He replaced the water with beer. So it's brandy, rum, sugar, and a little bit of beer. And he would have drunk it not necessarily even that chilled.
Lordy. So that's what we're going to embark on. But as you said, by the time we get to the 1850s and the height of the gold rush, blow my skull off has turned into something else.
It's grown in its sort of mythology, but it's also grown in its ingredients. And the sort of the key addition... that is nice. The key addition by this time is a little cayenne pepper to give you a bit of zing.
Which you've brought along.
I have. And some opium, which I haven't brought along. And it's mentioned... I'll pass this one over. It's mentioned in police gazettes of the era that if you find a group of men up in the goldfields of Ballarat drinking this, don't try to arrest them. In fact, don't even get off your horse. You just need to club them into unconsciousness because they're mad. There's no reasoning with them.
We're about to embark on that long, slow journey to hell. This is Blow My Skull Off.
Cheers.
Cheers. With cocktail historian Sebastian Rayburn.
Mm. Oh. Oh, that is nice.
Is drinkable.
That's
beer, brandy.
Rum and sugar.
Rum and sugar.
With a little spice. We put some black pepper, some cayenne, and a little bit of bitters as well. The culture at that time was a dining out culture because you've got to remember people were cooking with fire or with coal at home.
Rudimentary.
Yeah, and it costs a lot of money to ship an aga out on a wooden boat. So a lot of the time they weren't using a proper wooden stove. They were just using what is effectively a barbecue. Whereas these establishments, even some of them had gas cooking, which at that stage was incredibly new. And
so if you roll into town and you're flash with nuggets spilling out of your pockets, where do you head?
That's right. You can't eat at home. And so going out to eat became very much a part of the Melbourne thing. And funnily enough, the crash of the 1890s didn't stop it. People still went out. They still spent the money. And things got a little cheaper, but certainly they didn't lose patronage. And it was really the Great War that slowed
down. Finally stopped it.
Yeah, and then obviously the...
Which just goes to show you drink to celebrate, but you also drink to forget.
Yeah, but the Great War, it was considered inappropriate. If you had wealth, you shouldn't show it.
Right.
You know, because you should be putting what you could towards the great cause. And that's obviously when it all disappeared. And this is why this information sort of been lost. Because we had the Great War, we had the most absurd licensing laws ever at our 6 o'clock closing. And then Spanish flu and the Depression and the Second World War. So really there was this sort of 50-year, two-generation gap before Melbourne started to retake its place as a culinary capital of Australia.
And lift up its skirts and say, I'm pleased to be here.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. Cocktail historian and a mixologist in his own right, Sebastian Rayburn. You're with RN First Bite. I'm Michael McKenzie.